We've done a number of segments on the show about the private security contractors operating in Iraq and Afghanistan. But actually, as Sarah Stillman learned during a year-long investigation, armed security personnel make up only a small part, 16% of the contracting force, and over 60% of the total in Iraq alone are hired hands from third world countries, serving as cooks, cleaners, electricians, and even beauticians. And many of them have been lured into the war zones, often on false pretenses. Sarah Stillman's article, The Invisible Army, appeared in last week's The New Yorker, and I'm very pleased that she was able to talk with us today. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me on the show.
Do you have any idea of just how many third country nationals or TCNs there are?
What's fascinating is that nobody does, even the U.S. government, and it's both fascinating and kind of frightening. The estimates are that there's upwards of 70,000. You know, the U.S. government, the Defense Department alone tracks 60,000 third country nationals, and then you have many that I document in the piece who are kind of being smuggled onto the bases, being held in warehouses. So Secretary of Defense Gates acknowledged that it's a bit of a problem that we don't even have a way to keep tabs precisely on these workers, but it's a huge number, and they're ubiquitous on bases. You can't miss them.
And how long has this been going on? Ever since the invasion?
Yeah, I mean, this is unprecedented in the history of American warfare, but in the context of these two wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, in the earlier years of the war, you saw more workers who were being smuggled onto the bases, not even knowing that they were going to wind up in Iraq or Afghanistan, oftentimes being promised great jobs in Kuwait or Dubai. I think increasingly you see less of that and more workers who are so desperate for the war zone jobs themselves that they end up being duped and paying these huge fees that then it takes them nearly a year of work to actually pay back.
So they actually have to pay a hefty fee to secure this job
yeah.
That they then turns out to be nothing like what they've been told?
Exactly, exactly. And it's a very convoluted subcontracting chain. So you have the U.S. government paying a company like, say, KBR based in Texas, and then KBR paying a Kuwaiti company, perhaps, or a company based in Dubai, which is then paying a local recruiter on the ground in some of the world's poorest countries, so, say, Sierra Leone or Nepal or India. And the U.S. government has no idea what these rogue entrepreneurs are promising people. So usually I found the fee was somewhere between, you know, 1,000 and, you know, as much as 6,000 U.S. dollars that they're paying to get the jobs. And often they think they're being promised that they'll make it back in, you know, a month or two when they get to Iraq or Afghanistan. But in most cases, you know, some of these workers are making $250 a month working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day.
And under what kinds of conditions?
You know, it varies a lot depending on the contractor and the base. You know, some of the workers that I document in the piece were being held on one of the largest U.S. military bases in Baghdad. They were being held without sufficient food by their company. It's a Dubai-based company called Prime Projects International, and they literally got to the point where 1,200 Indian and Nepali men rioted, saying that they needed more food. You know, other of the workers, they get to eat alongside U.S. soldiers in the chow hall. They're very grateful for the jobs because they are making, you know, a lot more than they could make in their home countries. So it really depends. Because this is such a huge population, you see all kinds of cases.
But I'm assuming that the worst conditions are noted by U.S. military officials. Do they do anything to correct the situation?
Yeah, I mean, what's so stunning and quite disturbing is that we allow the subcontractors to have their own kind of labor camps on the U.S. bases, and oftentimes U.S. personnel aren't even allowed. You know, an average soldier could not walk into the camps and inquire about the conditions. So they tend to only hear about it when there are these massive riots or, you know, these massive instances of worker protest, and, you know, which can also hold up U.S. soldiers getting what they need, whether it be food or fuel. And so, you know, in one of the instances I write about in the piece and in several of the food riots, U.S. military personnel came to the camp and they tried to inquire on the workers' behalf, but the workers were too terrified to talk to them because, again, they'd paid these huge recruiting fees, and if they were sent home to their countries, they would be, you know, at the mercy of the loan sharks who they borrowed from to get there. So the U.S. government has not put very much energy into oversight, and as a result, there's very little accountability or transparency or even knowledge about what's going on.
How aware are these people are Al-Qaeda and other extremist groups?
Well, one of the kind of disturbing phenomenon that I document in the piece is that, you know, earlier in the wars, Al-Qaeda and some of the militants actually would target specifically third country nationals who were ferrying in the goods that were kind of servicing U.S. troops, so people who were trucking in fuel or even big truckloads of Cinnabon and kind of Pizza Hut supplies. And they were, you know, many of them were killed, many of them were kidnapped. And, you know, in some cases, I didn't get to write about this much, but, you know, for instance, in a truckload of Nepalis were actually taken by insurgents, and 11 of the men were shot, and another one was beheaded. In another case, a Filipino was kidnapped, and the insurgents actually sent a video to the government in the Philippines saying, you have to withdraw, otherwise we will kill this man. And they actually made it illegal for their workers to go to Iraq, and the man was freed. And now Angelo de la Cruz is a celebrity in the Philippines.
My guest is Sarah Stillman, a visiting scholar at NYU's Arthur L. Carter Journalism Institute and the recipient of its inaugural reporting award. She has written an article called The Invisible Army that was in the June 6th issue of The New Yorker, called The Invisible – oh, I said that, called The Invisible Army. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. When and how did you first learn about these TCNs?
It was actually through a sort of odd circumstance. I was doing a reporting embed on a U.S. military base in 2008. I was embedded with a military police unit, and I saw that there was a beauty salon on the base, and that struck me as a little odd. I went inside, and there were soldiers getting manicures and pedicures and facials, and I started chatting with the women, who then became kind of the central sort of narrative of the piece, a group of Fijian women who were beauticians in the salon, who told me about how they'd essentially been promised these great jobs in Dubai when they were back home in Fiji, and they signed up and they got on a plane and eventually learned instead they would be going to Iraq. So I write about them in the piece, and after hearing their story and seeing all the documentation behind it, I started speaking to other workers on the base and found that almost everyone had some kind of remarkable and often incredibly haunting story.
Has their situation ever been reported on back in Fiji?
You know, what's interesting is that the man who and the company that essentially duped these women also made promises to, you know, upwards of 20,000 Fijians, some of whom wound up in Iraq, some of whom are even still being recruited for jobs that he promises will pay them $10,000 a month, which seems a little dubious. And the Fijian press has kind of knocked on this man's door, and they actually sort of succeeded in getting a national investigation in Fiji into this man's recruiting company. But nevertheless, as I mentioned, he continues to recruit despite a court case against him.
Well, this doesn't sound all that different from what we've been seeing in the sex trade. Is that also part of the story?
You know, that's part of the sort of the underworld that I think is very hard to penetrate and to find out much about. You know, I write in the piece about how I encountered women who alleged that they were sexually assaulted by supervisors and how it was quite difficult to find where one would go for recourse in that kind of a circumstance. And I certainly heard similar stories of prostitution on the base. But it's interesting, the majority of these workers are actually men. I would say upwards of 90% are men coming from the poorest countries in the world trying to make money to send home to their families.
But you mostly talk to these women, Fijian women, 10 women who you mentioned refused to work for 2 weeks. Did they get any of the things they were demanding?
No, in fact, quite the opposite. They, you know, when they were in Fiji, they were promised they'd be making as much as $3,800 a month. And when they got to Iraq, they found out they'd actually be making $800 a month in a war zone that they had heard nothing about. And after bargaining, you know, they worked their wages up a small bit. But then they were transferred to another subcontractor on another base, and their wages went down to $350 a month, working 7 days a week, 12 hours a day.
So it's very hard for them to get back home. How long do they typically stay?
You know, I've met workers who have literally been there since the very beginning of this war, who have worked almost every day of it. And, you know, they've been there and seen various battalions come and go. And then there are others. The Fijian women stayed about a year, nearly a year.
Well, what happened to Vinnie and Lydia, two of your Fiji ladies?
They finally went home to Fiji, and they've resumed jobs working in beauty salons. Some of them have started working or gone back to working in jobs in nice resorts where they give massages to tourists and where they're actually making more money than they made risking their lives in a war zone. So I think they're quite happy to be home.
Well, Vinny ran into one of her recruiters not long ago. Did she get any satisfaction?
She had a little confrontation, and all of the women have kind of gone back. Most of the women have gone back to the offices, and you know, and essentially had a feud when they found that the recruiting office had posted a photographs of them in Iraq, saying, you know, lovely ladies enjoying their time in Iraq. At which point they said, you know, they warned them, it's a small world, and they better not fool any more women into this sort of thing. But again, like I said, Timothy Lalohia, the man in charge of the company, has a website up that you can look at today. His logistics company is making still these great promises for jobs in Dubai. So I think accountability is still quite questionable or elusive.
The U.S. military plans a major pullout in Iraq next month. What will happen to these workers when that happens? And I'm assuming there'll also be pullouts in Afghanistan. Will these workers not be needed?
You know, I think that's a major concern, is how will they get home? I met a number of workers, including one on Kandahar airfield, who had been, he'd paid a big fee to get there, and he was randomly fired from the job because they no longer needed him. And he was sitting there, almost in tears with this letter from his company saying, you know, thank you for your service, and had no way to get home. The company was, it's mandatory for them to provide the flight, but oftentimes these workers are abandoned on the base. Recently in Iraq, you saw the same thing. A colonel who's in charge of some of the contracting enforcement put out a memo to all the contractors saying, you have to stop leaving these guys behind on the base. They're essentially this new breed of kind of homeless men living on our bases, some of whom are undocumented, just kind of trying to figure out how to get home. And I think you're also seeing another phenomenon, which is quite worrisome, of these rogue entrepreneurs in these home countries who continue to make promises to the workers at the same rate, you know, going into the hills of, say, Nepal and promising a great job. The workers are then flown into Baghdad, held in warehouses off the base, sometimes for, you know, 2 or 3 or 4 months. I interviewed workers who'd just been stranded there, no pay, very little food, waiting these jobs they'd been promised that are increasingly unlikely to exist at all. So I think that's a big question that the military is going to have to face.
We have a link to Sarah Stillman's article on our show page at WNYC.org. The article, The Invisible Army, appeared in the June 6th issue of The New Yorker. Thank you so much for being with us, Sarah.
Yeah, thanks a lot for having me on the show.